Welcome to Coming Up for Air, the Allies in Recovery podcast, with hosts Laurie McDougall, Kayla Solomon, and Dominique Simone Levine.
Okay, Kayla, so you came up with a great topic for us to discuss. I really want to get into this a little bit today. I think all our listeners will really benefit from this. So what's the topic?
Okay, so the topic is holding on to contradictions. And what we mean is that so many people come to us and they're very focused. My loved one's in trouble. I have to get them help. I have to save their lives. I have to make sure everything goes well and works out. And what we've discovered is that not only is this process not simple, but how do you do that is not simple. So there's all different kinds of things going on. And what we want to do is clarify. Sometimes when we're talking about this, it sounds confusing and contradictory. So we want to actually take some time and clarify.
And let me say this, it is contradictory a lot of the time. And I call it white knuckling. And let me just explain a little bit, because, you know, our loved ones white knuckle it in the beginning. And what white knuckling is considered to be when we're talking substance use is just don't use. Everything else gets put on hold and you're kind of grabbing onto that table and white knuckling it. Just don't use. And you'll hear it all the time that people are white knuckling it for about the first year of their recovery. Just don't use. No matter what comes along, just don't use. But I also think us family members do the same type of thing. We white knuckle it. Just don't go up there and feel good feelings. Just this way, if something happens, I don't have to fall too far. I'm not going to feel the balance. I'm not going to feel joy too much, because if I do, and I know that hammer is going to drop at some point, and when I do, I have much farther to drop in my emotions. And I don't want to feel that way. I don't want to be really high with joy and then drop really low with depression and anxiety. So I call it white knuckling it. So I will just stay right here, right in the middle, not feeling anything. I'm not going to feel the joy. I'm going to try really hard not to feel the lows. I'm just going to hold on tight and go along for the ride.
Oh, this reminds me of my family, because as time went on, I realized that I came from a family that I then deemed optimistic pessimists. Literally, they would say in my family, expect the worst and hope that you're wrong and you'll never be disappointed. The irony of that perspective is that you're chronically disappointed because you kind of feel nothing and you expect nothing. And by the way, if you expect nothing, you usually get nothing. So it's actually, I learned the hard way, not a great way to approach life. And so what we talk about a lot is having hope. And what's happened to me over time is I realized hope is not this irrational, crazy thing. Hope doesn't guarantee anything. It doesn't make anything happen. It just allows you to have a little space inside where you're not being pulled into the dark undertow of the negative thoughts and feelings. It allows you to have a little bit of light even while you're struggling, which, by the way, is a contradiction, because you could be struggling and still have hope, or you could still have faith. It's not an exclusive situation. You get to have lightness even when you're in a dark place.
Right. I totally agree. And I was doing this white knuckling it when I first started on my journey. And maybe I had to in some ways in order to protect myself. Maybe it was just some kind of a protective measure that I was taking. But it's really hard to do, because what it did was kind of like what you're saying, it left me with not much. And so I basically felt like I'm holding everything together 24/7, and I am using up all my energy trying to just hold myself in this one spot. Don't go too high. Don't go too low. But in fact, it was just draining me And I really actually was never, I was in a dark spot, although I wasn't in the deep muck of it, although something could happen and push me right down there. But I was never experiencing happiness, and it was just taking its toll on me.
You had weighed it down. And so, you know, it really, this is one of the most essential things that we work with craft, which is that if you're just looking at what's not going well, or making sure that you're hanging on and managing, you actually stop living. You're waiting. You're in this kind of purgatory where, unless the other person makes some really big move in a positive direction, you're stuck, because it's this almost like you're in a waiting role. And I don't know how anybody else feels. I hate waiting. Give me negative information and I'm better off, because then I'm doing something. But this in-between waiting part of like, are they going to do what needs to happen? Are they going to do something awful? Are they going to like talk to me? Are they going to call me? Are they going to let me know that? That's all waiting. And when you're waiting, you are helpless.
Well, and let me add to that, because I think it can be even deeper than that, because what I was waiting for was not any of the good. It was, I'm waiting for the very difficult, bad things to happen, because I know it's coming. I know it's coming. And so it's worse. It's deeper than that, because it's like, I can never have joy or positivity in my life. I can't, because I'm just sitting here. I am just holding it together. And I am waiting. Like everybody says, I'm waiting. I know the hammer's going to drop. It's coming. And I need to be prepared for it. And the worst thing I could be experiencing would be happiness and joy. Because if I do, oh my gosh, when I, those feelings, losing those feelings and going back into the muck of things, it's almost like it's too much to bear. How do I do that? It's just too much to bear. So instead, I just won't feel the happiness and joy. I just won't feel that. I'll just stay right here, white knuckling it, waiting for the hammer to drop. And then when the hammer drops, at least I'm already here. Or at least I'm really close to here. And so you're right. I really couldn't experience life. And I will tell you this, it's such an awful place to be, because really what's happening is you're not letting in the wonderful things that you actually have in your life. And I mean, people. I was so involved in that awful negative piece in my mind and in my emotions that I couldn't enjoy and benefit from the beautiful other people and other things that I had in my life. And I have other people, you know, my husband is a wonderful man. I have some incredible friends. I have other children, which they're all adults now, but, and they're beautiful people. And I couldn't be there for them either.
Well, and what happens is that what you're really doing is you're, whether you're officially depressed in that state or not is semantics, but you're basically mirroring depression if you're acting in that way or thinking that way or moving forward in that way. And, you know, as I like to say, it's kind of like people who say, I'm just going to go lay down. Laying down with the lights off in the darkness, I call it the international symbol of depression. Okay. So if you're avoiding things, if you're shutting the light, if you're not dealing, if you're just kind of hunkering down, that's what depression feels like. So even if you're not clinically depressed, you're in a depressed state, you're suppressed, you're smaller, you're not looking at the world as a whole. So now what we need to do is shift over to this bigger picture that we're talking about, is why is it important to hold the contradictions? And the reason it's important to hold the contradictions, in my perspective, is that that actually is a muscle that you need to develop to have a full life. Okay. Because if you're all positive all the time and you're like little Mary Sunshine and stuff like that, I consider that dysfunctional. It's like, it's not real. It's kind of like people who, you know, are really happy, but they're afraid something bad is going to happen. Just so we know, let's clarify, if you're alive and breathing on this planet, something bad is going to happen. That no longer feels like pessimism to me. That's realism. you know, things happen. People get sick. People die. Yesterday somebody came in and she hit the curb and she had a flat tire. That's a bad thing. It might not be bad 10 out of 10, but it certainly did not make her day. So things happen all the time. You don't have enough money. People disappoint you. You feel alone. Your old stuff comes up and somebody triggers you, whatever. That's part of life. So it's not that we're saying, you know, we want you never to think anything bad's going to happen. Of course, the bad things are going to happen. But as a recovering optimistic pessimist, where I did expect things to go wrong all the time, once I shifted to, oh, let me find the good. Let me look for the good. Let me have some positive expectations. Let me work towards the positive expectations. It was astonishing how much better my life got and how more resilient I was. Because if I have positive, I am much, much better equipped to handle the negative. If I'm depressed, I can't do anything.
That's a hard thing to see when you're in the midst of it, right? It's a really difficult thing to see. And there's often challenging feelings that come along with this idea of things are so horrible. I mean, family members can feel guilty for feeling, you know, emotions of joy and happiness when their loved one is going through all of this stuff. It's almost like we can feel like I shouldn't feel that way. Also, that's exactly what I experienced too, Kayla. I would say I'm not an optimistic pessimist. I'm optimistic. And I have some natural kind of level of dopamine in me that I can't stay down mood-wise for very long. I do get down, but I find that it passes pretty quickly. And then I'm in a better state like really quickly. So I tend to be on the optimistic side of things. So that was a really tough one for me to be like, nope, you can't feel that. Nope. Do not feel happiness. Do not feel joy. It was really taking a lot of energy out of me to do that. But it also, I met this woman. We actually interviewed her on here. This was years ago. Her name is Pam Ricard. She's with the Heron Project. And she came on and she said, oh no, dear. She said their exact words were, oh no, dear, you're a human being. You're supposed to feel joy and happiness and sadness and frustration and anger and despair when these things happen. And she said, feel your feelings, feel all of them. Mm. And I walked away from that conversation going, oh my gosh, right? Oh my gosh, I'm supposed to feel happy and I'm supposed to feel sad and anger and despair and frustration, and I'm supposed to feel joy. After she said that, it was like an aha. I call them aha moments for myself, these epiphanies that I have. And what I started to do was like, I would get invited to a friend's house for some kind of a party or a gathering. And I remember the first time that I allowed myself to feel good when I was at this gathering, and I almost started crying because it was like, oh my gosh, look at what I had pushed out of my life. Such wonderful people that I have in my life. And my life does not consist of only addiction. It doesn't. And it just compounded exponentially onto that, because I almost started to appreciate the depression and the anxiety at the same time that it was like, oh, wait a minute. I'm supposed to feel this way in a very difficult situation. But also, I started to realize, oh my God, this is not the only thing that I have in my life. Not only is it not the only thing that I have in my life, I have a lot more of positive things in my life than I do of negative things in my life.
Yeah. And so I want to get to other contradictions too, because this is a huge one, but there's more. So another thing that we talk about all the time in craft is I want to support my loved one and be connected, and I want to have good boundaries. That is an inherent contradiction if you're dealing with somebody who has substance abuse. And so we want to talk about why we say that. So this goes back to what you're talking about, Lori, which is that the connection is really what we're communicating with them. It's how we're addressing them, how we're recognizing any microscopic good things that we're doing, remembering who they are, not necessarily saying, oh, remember the days before you were an addict, but it's more like, oh, I know you love cars, or I know you love basketball, or I know, you know, I was thinking, I saw this cat video and I know you love this, or I heard this song and I think you would like this. Things like that, where we do this all the time with other people and we don't even realize that we're doing it. We just do it because it's easy. But when we have a loved one that's using, those connectors start fraying because we only think of them as somebody who's using substances. And maybe they only think about themselves that way as well, because it's such a priority in their lives. And so we're all in this belief that, oh, you know, you're a substance user. That's all that's the only thing that you are. And what we're talking about is stepping back and seeing their humanity, seeing their positives, seeing the little charming, lovely things that they do in these tiny little microscopic moments when there is a very good chance that they're not high at that second or they're less high. So you get to feed that. And, you know, there's a whole thing actually in the big book, there's this whole section, Dr. Alcoholic Addict, where he talks about when he has a particular perception, it's exceptionally powerful. So when he was drinking and he would look at his wife, he detested her. She drove him crazy. Everything that she did was wrong. But then when he got clean, he started to realize, and he was actually sober. He wasn't, he's like, wow, she's great. And what happened was what you focus on gets bigger. And that's what he said. He said, what you focus on. So if you're focusing on the negative, you will find that everywhere, especially in this world. There's plenty of negative to find out, but finding the positive is a tougher work when you're in a difficult state. You need to actually develop it as a practice, because like everything else, if you do it more and more, it will get larger. It will get to be more second nature to you, as opposed to a struggle to find what's good. But it changes the relationship and it changes your internal reaction to this person and your life.
Just a couple of things on that. Yeah, I think that when we're down in the lows and really in the muck of things, it's on our mind 24/7. And so we project it onto our loved ones 24/7. Every time they come in the door, all we talk about are their problems, you know, their addiction, how they're going to fix it. All we're doing is obsessing about how can I reach this person? How can I get this person to do this, that, and the other thing, right? How can I get them into treatment? How can I get them to stop using? I mean, they literally walk through the door and the first thing you're doing is checking their eyes, smelling their breath, right? Like it's 24/7. And so this particular piece of it actually adds a little bit of balance to that. And what Kayla's saying is, and this is exactly what I'm trying to convey, once I started feeling both feelings, I started to see my loved one differently. Like I started to say, well, what's wrong with me? I've got all these other beautiful people in my family, right? I've got all these incredible friends that are in my life. I am really blessed. I have a roof over my head. I have food that I can fill my belly with, right? Like I am a really blessed person. And I also started looking at my loved one and I started to say to myself, well, wait a minute, that's not all he is either. He's not just his addiction. He is a wonderful person, actually. He's very sensitive. He's brilliant in school, you know, and so everything started to change, which I tend to be optimistic anyway. So it was a huge relief for me, but actually it tipped the scale in the other direction in that I started to realize I have more good in my life than I do the negative in my life.
You have to focus on that to find it. Because when you're struggling, it's the hardest thing to find.
Right, because your mind is just constantly focused on this one extremely difficult problem, and that's all you can think about. And I also think under certain circumstances, you know, I had I had a very traumatic introduction to substance use disorder, like an instant, a moment. It was like, it is in your face. And I was diagnosed with PTSD. In that instant, it was like I went from being pretty happy, relatively, you know, things, yeah, we had our problems or whatever, and we were working on them, to, oh my gosh, no, this is how bad it is. Things are really, really bad. And it just became really difficult to focus on those, the good things in my life. And I had to reach out for help.
Well, but the other thing is, if you have PTSD, that means that the hardwiring goes to protection, safety, and that includes negativity. So the reason that we go negative with this is it's the primitive wiring of, if you're in danger, you have to protect yourself. You have to be ready for danger. But because it becomes so chronic, it becomes dysfunctional. It's one thing if you have these moments where you're looking for danger. It's another thing when you're actually in that state all the time. And then it's actually dysfunctional because you're not assessing things well. You're actually distorted.
Right. And I wasn't. I was totally dysfunctional. And I've said this before on the podcast, I literally spent 6 months on the couch. And I wasn't necessarily feeling all down all the time or depressed, which I probably was incredibly depressed. I felt numb. And it took me a while, but it was reaching out for help. And it was these moments in my life and people that I interacted with, like what you're talking about, Kayla, when I interacted with Pam Ricard and she said these things, it was like, oh no, I gotta feel my feelings. And as soon as I opened up that door, I can't tell you how much happiness and joy just flooded in. And it was to a level where I could almost cry. I was so happy. It's like I had forgotten that feeling.
Yes. And speaking of that, what I think we also need to address is another contradiction, which is, how do you find joy in your relationship, especially if you're in, like, if your parents or the people who are not using in your life, how do you find joy when things are so, like, okay, so here's some example. I'm going to be specific because there's so many people that we know of that their adult children are living with them. They're behaving incredibly erratically, dangerously, negatively. I'll go on and on, but no need. And then here you have the parental unit that literally, the way I look at it is, you're being held hostage because you can't leave the house because you're worried about what they're going to do when you leave. You know, are they going to steal? Are they going to destroy something? Are they going to have a party at your house? There's all these people that have these scenarios. And so you don't get to go on vacation with your partner. You don't get to, like, go out on a date because you're terrified that if you leave your, in this case, a child at home, and I don't mean a 5-year-old, I'm talking about a 25-year-old, then something bad is going to happen. So it's like, how do you actually find the joy when you may not be able to leave the house in any safe way because of what's going on? But if you're a couple, then how do you find joy in those moments?
You know what? Because I was in that situation and I kind of gave into it at one point and just said, actually, going out and doing these things is so difficult for me right now that I'm just not going to do them, that I'm just going to give into it and just say, okay, because I tried a couple of times. I did try and go out. Well, I would never go away for a weekend. Absolutely not. Or going out, I was just so beyond. It just wasn't working. So I gave into it and said, okay, that's just not going to happen. But I also was very aware that things never stay the same, that over time that would change. And so what I did was I decided, I did a whole bunch of different things. I'd go out with my girlfriends and my husband and I would take turns going out and doing various things. I'd invite my loved one out. Let's go out together and find it. And oftentimes, like, we would get invited to family events and we would bring them with us. Or other things that I did was I had events at my house and I would pull people in. But I found small little ways to start to change that and bring happiness and joy and interacting with other people back into my life.
So let me see if this is a fit at this moment. But what I find is that it goes back to the either or, the not holding of the contradiction. So for me, it's like, you know, like if I'm having a time in my relationship where I feel like I'm not getting my needs met from my partner, I'm like, oh, it's all not working out, because it's easy to do that too. And one of the things that I have learned over time, and I'm not great at this, is appreciating and noticing the little joys of life and acknowledging them. So there's creating them, which is like creating little opportunities for joy and making openings for them. But then there's also being a receiver of them. So when something lovely happens, that you take it in, and here's my way of saying this, because it used to be that nothing counted. Like, oh yeah, that's nice, whatever. And it just rolls off. But like to be able to say, oh, I'm taking it in, I'm receiving it, this counts. And then it's almost like putting it in the bank of positivity, which you need to be filling up at all times, because there's plenty of withdrawals from that account. So how do I like create little moments of joy with my partner, with my family, with myself, with my activities, so that I'm a joy receiver? And also, if you're in a relationship, even if you don't go out, that you're making these little precious moments where you feel good with each other, where you're getting taken care of by each other, even if you're not leaving the house.
So I like what you're saying, Kayla. And I think that's a really important piece, because a lot of family members get stuck in black and white thinking. I've either got to be able to go out and go away for a weekend or not. And that's the only way I can get joy in my life, is that I can go out alone, or if my husband and I can go out and we can leave them at home. It's not about that. It's not black and white. There's lots of gray in the middle, and there's lots of ways to find little bits of joy that benefit you and your loved one with substance use disorder. It could be as simple as saying, hey, I'm running down to Dunkin' Donuts and I'm going to get a coffee. Do you want to come with me? And then you get in the car and there's no discussion about, you know, problems or anything. You just turn up the music, you put on a rap song or something, and you go, is this the music you like? And you go and you start to dance or whatever, and just appreciate that 10, 20 minutes of moment with your loved one. And it's bringing those small little pieces. That's what's going to, one, that's going to build that connection, but also it allows you to go ahead and have your boundaries. It makes you, you're ready for this, and family members will know what I'm talking about. It makes you feel a little bit less guilty when you do set down a boundary, because you're keeping the connection, but it's okay for you to have some personal needs and wants to be asking for that, which is what a boundary is. Something you said that's really important, and I kind of want to build off of that, and that is that, remember, this is actually not selfish, because a lot of family members feel very selfish when they are pursuing joy and happiness. They feel like it's a selfish thing, but the thing is, it's actually not selfish. It's not, because you can look at it as you're doing this for your loved one, because that allows you to bring the best you to the table. If you're bringing the sick, depressed, anxious person in despair to the table, how are you able to interact with anybody when you're in that kind of a state? Not well.
In that state, you're disconnected from yourself. So you cannot connect with somebody else if you're disconnected from yourself. And the other thing is that you become Debbie Downer. You're like, wah, wah. And nobody wants to be around that. You're like judging and you're being critical and you see only the negative. And then you become a repellent to your loved one. You want to be somebody that they come to, and you don't have to offer that much other than your way of being in the world, and then just transmitting positivity. So I think this is a good time for us to summarize, if that's okay.
Can I just say one thing before we go? I do want to just quickly touch on language a little bit. I just want to let our listeners know, once in a while, we kind of slip a little bit with our language. And there are a few things that we might have said, especially like when we talked about the title of the book and that kind of thing. But just a few things, like we try not to use the word sober. Instead, we say things like person in recovery, working on their recovery, abstinent, and we don't like to refer to our loved ones by their illness. We try really hard, you know, loved one, individual, person. And I just kind of want to throw that out there because I don't want our listeners to think that we're not working on it, because we are. We just slip sometimes. That's all.
And the reason I use sober for the doctor in the big book is that's the word that he used. And so that's why I described it that way, because that's exactly what he's talking about. And, you know, we also think about recovery in terms of more of a process and more subtle than you're either abstinent or not. It's much more subtle with what we're talking about. But that's a different discussion. So to summarize today, and it's interesting that we're talking about holding contradictions, because I feel like the real comprehensive way of looking at it is to really become a complex thinker, where it's not one way or another, black or white, good or bad, even using or not using. It's much more that we are really looking at a bigger picture and trying to see the range of possibilities in it, to be able to hold more than one truth, to be able to know that there are many, many things happening at the same moment, and that they don't erase the other things. It's like you can hold more than one thing. And so if you think about what we're describing, and this is what all self-work is about, is becoming more of yourself, more whole. And in order to do that, it's kind of like what you were talking about, Lori. You have to have all the feelings, not just some of them. You have to have lots of different thoughts, not just a few of them. You have to be able to hold contradictory thoughts and opinions at one time. And you also have to be able to see your perspective and the other person's perspective. And neither of them are right or wrong. They're just different. And the bigger you get, the more you can hold so many different possibilities, and it makes you more whole. And all of the work that we're talking about is healing into wholeness. That's my new shtick. It's healing into wholeness. If you're listening to us, you have this massive opportunity to heal into wholeness. So that's what you could be grateful for, if you've been provided for this opportunity.
Thank you, Kayla. And we'll talk again next week.
Thanks for listening. We hope this episode of Coming Up for Air spoke to you. If you're listening in today on a podcast platform that isn't the Allies member site, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating. This helps others find the show more easily. If you have a suggestion for a new topic or a guest for the show, please reach out through the Contact Us form on alliesinrecovery.net. Special thanks to our hosts, our guests, and our production team.